paradise on earth. That's what a lot of travelers seek. But to actually find it requires traveling within as well as without. For 50 years, Pico Iyer has been letting us stow away with him through his books as he ventures to distant lands, both within and without. In his latest book, The Half-Known Life in Search of Paradise, Pico shares his quest for paradise on earth in places as far-flung as Iran and India, Kashmir, Sri Lanka, the Australian bush, and mountainside temples in Japan. And he shares a perspective that might help us recognize paradise wherever we are. Pico joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves from Kyoto in Japan. Pico, thanks for being with us.
So happy to talk to you again, Rick.
You know, I know you well enough, Pico, that you don't just write a book to entertain. Like the traveler's guru, you have more to offer. Tell us what you mean by the name of your book, The Half-Known Life, and why you wrote it.
It comes from my sense that, especially when I was a kid, but even now, I'm often a know-it-all. I'll sit at home, I'll pontificate upon human realities and universal values, and then I'll get off the plane in North Korea, and nothing I say begins to apply to that. The world is much more various than we imagine, and it's much more interesting than our ideas. And so the half-known life refers in part to the fact that everything interesting in our lives is what we can't understand. What's bigger than us? And that's what I want to explore, whether I'm sitting at home or whether I'm traveling across the globe.
And you've done that vividly in your book, you know, and there's a lot of places you visit in the book, but I'd like to take this few minutes we have together and delve into South Asia, India, Sri Lanka, head up north to Kashmir to learn more about your thoughts, your quest for paradise on earth, and then how or perhaps why these places, you know, so romanticized in our minds as paradises, all have something very powerful in common, and that, sadly, is war. So, let's go to India. You know, when it comes to paradise, India really is a place that's sort of infatuated with paradise. Where would we go in India to find a billion Hindus' interest in paradise?
Well, I think the epicenter of Hindu India, as you know, is the holy city of Varanasi. And although I don't know what to do with the power and magnetism of that place, I'm pulled there again and again because it has such charisma. And I remember one time I was standing along the holy river Ganges there, looking at this scene of great confusion and dead bodies floating past and flames on both sides of me consigning corpses to ash. And I just didn't know what to do with it, even though I'm of Indian descent and 100% Hindu on paper. And suddenly I heard two people call my name. One, they were both Tibetan Buddhist monks, one an older Tibetan and one a much younger American, who is the first Westerner in history to be named the head of a Tibetan Buddhist temple by the Dalai Lama. And my American friend, whom I'd last seen on Fifth Avenue in New York City, looked at the same chaos. He said, "Isn't this wonderful? This is the reality we have to embrace. This is birth and death and everything in between. This is what we have to celebrate." And it was so humbling to me that somebody from another tradition could see the same chaos that freaked me out and realize this is where we had to find paradise, in the middle of real life.
Pico, that's a line that I actually jotted down from your book. Let me read it to you and tell me if I'm on target here. You wrote, "Varanasi, it's a compendium of all the world's pleasures and confusions, the churning current of Varanasi through everything and its opposite together, and declared all of it holy." Whoa!
You know, I'm often, especially when I'm traveling, I'm inclined to say, this place is sacred and this is profane. Here in Kyoto, I want to go to the temple. I don't want to go to the 7-Eleven. And yet, if I talk to a wise local, they will say, well, the 7-Eleven is just as suffused with grace and kindness and the things you're looking for as the temple. Don't make these distinctions. They exist in your head, and the world is much more complex.
It's so hard to explain India. It's a weird thing. I make my living explaining Ireland and Spain and Denmark, but my favorite country is India. And to be honest, I don't even like talking about it because it's exhausting to try to explain to people the chaotic magic of India, the compost pile of life and love and commotion and people. When it comes to love, the tonnage of love in India is amazing. We're still in Varanasi. Take us down the muddy lane, so dense with people. It's a human traffic jam. Each person is like a wild fantasy come true. Take us down that lane until we get to the river, the holy river.
Yes, I'm smiling as I listen to you, Rick, because India is the home of the inexplicable. Everything you see walking down the street, you can't begin to explain away. So in Varanasi, the lanes are very small. As you're walking along, there's a cow walking on one side. There's a little boy in an ill-lit shrine behind a flickering candle on the other. Suddenly, there's a roar of delight and people run past you carrying a dead body on a stretcher, their mother perhaps, whom they're delightedly committing to the flames in the holy city, which will allow her to be liberated from the cycle of rebirth. There are mosques, there are churches, every great religion is represented there. There are naked ascetics walking around smeared in ash. So as you said, love, terror, it's all happening within a few square feet.
And then before you get to the river, there's a plateau, a little high ground, and they've got fires up there. And these are funeral pyres with a view of the Ganges. And there's crackling and the sound of bodies crumbling with the wood in the fire as the flames devour some stranger. And then you imagined it being a loved one. I remember being there, and I can still see the bony feet sticking out of the fire like the tip of a log that's too long for the fireplace. And to go there, you realize what a beautiful place that is for Hindus and what a freaky place it is for a tourist.
Yes, and what a freaky place it is even for a Hindu who is a tourist like myself, and people poking at the bones and ashes with hoes, and also just in such a state of exaltation about what to us is such a shocking sight. And what I always remember is when I walk along the holy river at night, because it's such a kind of penumbral, ill-lit city, there's very little to see except the flames on both sides of you. So it's like a kind of hallucination or some psychedelic dream. It gets into your head and you just remember through the dark these flames, which is a good lesson because none of us is going to last forever. And the great monks in every tradition remind us the more we think about death, the more we'll appreciate life. So sometimes I'm almost grateful to be reminded I am going to be one of those bodies at some time. So let me make the most of right now.
And there's different faiths have the same kind of exercise. That's so interesting, the more you delve into that. And then, of course, the lane is leading to the holy river. And Hindus believe that they'll hike across India in order to be cremated there and worship in the river before they say goodbye. And the scene at the river is something to behold. And it's just, it's a vivid experience.
Very vivid. And when I was there the first time, it was in midwinter, which meant there's this huge fog. And there's a little sandy bank on the other side of the river. And you don't really know if you're dreaming this or actually experiencing it. It's spooky. The characters look like apparitions or dream figures or ghosts in the middle of this. And as I say, it's not a comforting place to be, but I recommend all my friends to go there because it's unique and they will never forget it.
Our guest on Travel with Rick Steves right now is author Pico Iyer. Pico examines some of the world's most potent holy sites in his book, The Half-Known Life, In Search of Paradise. You can find links to Pico's work in the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio, and you can learn more about Pico from his website, picoiyerjourneys.com. Iyer is spelled I-Y-E-R. And Pico, when we rave about India and we just love being there, as I mentioned, these paradises also have that dark civil unrest or war backdrop. And in India, we've got the reality of Hindu nationalism, which is as ugly as Christian nationalism, but with fewer law and order limits. There is that ugly side to the paradise of the Indian culture.
And I think there's always some kind of political chaos going on in India anytime. Mm-hmm. But I think when I travel, I try to ignore the constantly changing politics to see the character of the place behind it, which doesn't change so much. So what I love about India is, even though there are shopping malls and McDonald's and lots of traffic now, I think nothing's ever going to change India. The India 50 years from now is the same India that existed 200 years ago.
I guess I'm just selfishly thankful for that because I love the thought that I can go back to Varanasi and experience that. Hey, if you or I were a big shot, a Mughal in India, and we wanted to get a relief from the sun and the intensity of all, we would go up north to Kashmir, wouldn't we?
We would, yes. For centuries.
Yeah. It's an amazing place. Kashmir is the only majority Muslim state in the mostly Hindu India. And it, to me, is paradise in the foothills of the Himalayas or whatever it is. It's a lot of people claim the Garden of Eden was actually located up there. What's your take on Kashmir and Shangri-La?
It's so idyllic in places. I'm sure you've done this, Rick, but I was staying on a houseboat on Dal Lake in the capital of Kashmir, Srinagar. And when I looked out my window, there was nothing but a lotus pond. Absolute silence except for the whirring of kingfisher's wings. People would paddle past in little boats selling aromatic spices and beautiful carved boxes. I really thought this was as peaceful and heavenly as things could get. But of course, as you were saying, 10 minutes across the water in the city itself, 600,000 soldiers trying to keep an uneasy peace because both India and Pakistan have claimed it for 70 years, tanks, army encampments, barbed wire. And so in some ways, it's a tourist paradise as long as you neglect the reality for the people living there, which has been a very, very stressful one.
It's a heartbreaking one when you've had a chance to know the people of Kashmir, to think what they're going through and how seemingly intractable their tension is in that regard. Pico, one of my great regrets in my travel story is I got to Kashmir and I just didn't have the energy or the ability to go up to Ladakh. But what, just 100 miles or so further north, further into this mystical sort of Himalayan wonderland, is Ladakh from Kashmir. And it is, I know, a place near and dear to your heart. Tell us about Ladakh.
Well, I really hope you can get there sometime, Rick, because nowadays it's a one-hour easy flight from Delhi. And it's probably the best preserved and therefore most magical and pristine of the great Himalayan places. It's like Tibet if nobody had ever come to Tibet in some ways. You land at about 10,000 feet. It's the main town of Leh is a small cluster of whitewashed houses with a market in the middle that has been serving Silk Road travelers for centuries. And then when you drive out of the town, within about 10 minutes, you're in absolute nothingness, this kind of lunar wilderness surrounded by mountains. And halfway up the mountains are these magical big temples constructed almost impossibly on top of a ridge or halfway down a cliff, like the Patala Palace in Lhasa, Tibet, but even more so. And with a very living Tibetan culture and a living Tibetan agriculture all around it.
When we think about Ladakh, I think about the Dalai Lama, and I think how important the Dalai Lama has been in your life and your remarkable relationship with that spiritual leader. Tell us about the Dalai Lama and what impact he's had on your travels.
Well, you're absolutely right, Rick. Because he's been exiled from his own country, Tibet, for 64 years, he actually does go to Ladakh every year for most of August, because that is like being back home. And I've been very lucky to know him for 48 years, travel with him often. Every time he comes to Japan, my wife and I spend pretty much every minute of his working day right next to him. And he's an exemplary traveler, because I think wherever he goes, he's traveling not to teach, but to listen. And when he suddenly will arrive in Belfast or Jerusalem, he wants to find out about this place, to learn about them, and to see what he can bring back to his own people and community from them. I notice every morning when we travel with him, I step into his hotel room at 8:30, and there's a telescope there pointed outside the window. The Dalai Lama remembers wherever he travels on Earth, he's going to be able to see the heavens from a different angle. And he never takes that travel for granted, because before him, no Dalai Lama in history had ever been able to leave Asia. So I think I've learned a lot about how to travel from his endlessly curious, wide-eyed, and appreciative eyes.
Pico Iyer is our guest on Travel with Rick Steves, and he's the author of The Half-Known Life in Search of Paradise. Pico's written more than a dozen books about his adventures and observations in the world, and his TED Talks have been viewed more than 11 million times. Pico lists his upcoming speaking engagements and recent articles he's written on his website, picoiyerjourneys.com. Let's go to the far side of the Indian subcontinent and take a little boat ride and go to Sri Lanka, the island just to the south of India, as a paradise, as a place that people dream of paradise. What's your take on that island, formerly known as Ceylon, right, when it was part of Britain?
Yes, and I think Sri Lanka has had the same problem historically as Kashmir, which is precisely that it's paradise, and so everybody wants a piece of it. I know in Sri Lanka the Portuguese came in, and then the Dutch came in, and then the British came in, and now millions of us tourists just want to get a little scrap of Eden to take back home, which makes for a very difficult situation. Of course, there's been a difficult war there too between the majority Sinhalese and the Tamils. But even beyond that, it's a hard thing for a place like Sri Lanka to know that everybody in the rest of the world is looking at it with greedy or avaricious eyes.
They're sort of a victim of their own fertility because they have these wonderful tea plantations there, and that attracted the English, I guess, who love their tea, and the Sinhalese who live there didn't work as cheaply as the people from South India, the Tamils, so the English imported Tamils to do the tea picking, right?
Yes, exactly. And I think through history, it was also associated with rubies. It was called the Island of Gems. Everybody from Marco Polo onwards imagined it was this treasure house of jewels and therefore irresistible to people.
And then when the English got tired of it, they left. And what they left was a divided society with a lower class Tamil group. And they've had a tragic civil war. And my memories of Sri Lanka are very paradisical. I mean, wild fruit, thatched cabins on the beach, body surfing, mountains blanketed by idyllic tea plantations. But they've had a tough time.
They've had a very tough time. And what happened was, as soon as the British left, the majority Sinhalese took over, made their language the official language, rendering the Tamil people more or less illiterate, literally unable to speak the language. The Tamils formed the Tamil Tigers, rose up in revolt, and then we saw for maybe 30 years a quite violent civil war, which now has subsided happily.
Talk about buzzkill. Every time we build up a paradise, we realize there's some deep-seated problems that they're dealing with, just like all the places that we don't think that are paradise. There must be a lesson here overall. Have you given much thought to why so many of these paradises actually disappoint when we get there? What's the positive takeaway?
Something you said earlier in our talk, Rick, I think is the perfect explanation, which is paradise and humans probably don't go together. Humans are mortal. We can't create something perfect. And I think in some ways, finding paradise has to do more with accepting imperfection than looking for a perfection that we'll never find. I think it has not to do so much with looking for answers to the world, but living with delight in answerlessness, in the half-known space, in the fact that we'll never be on top of the world, and that's the beauty of it.
And maybe finding paradise has something to do with understanding that we have a creator, and if you do understand that, or if you do believe in that, that means we're all children of that creator, children of that God, and when we travel, we get to know the family. For you and for me, I think the closest places to paradise are when we connect with other people in the honest, crazy, chaotic commotion, the conviviality of this beautiful life we've been blessed with.
Exactly.
All right. Hey, well, that's the search for paradise. Pico Iyer, thanks for joining us. And as always, good travels.
Thank you, Rick.
Pico Iyer pulls together life lessons from nearly 50 years of roaming the world, sometimes to places others fear to tread, in his book, The Half-Known Life, In Search of Paradise. You can also listen to podcasts of Pico's earlier visits with us from our show archives. That's at ricksteves.com/radio. Russian royals sent European culture to Siberia by shipping pianos to the most far-flung places. A few years ago, Sophie Roberts went searching for them. She tells us what she found and why she did it next on Travel with Rick Steves.